Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Sashi Business Show. Today is Monday, June 2nd, 2025. I'm Abdul Majid Awan.
And I'm Warit Ahmed, and we've got a packed show for you today. So firstly, this is like historical news. Sheikha Al-Nuwais has made history as the first woman to lead UN World Tourism Organization, first Emirati woman. We're also going to be discussing how Elon Musk actually tried to block Sam Altman's big AI deal in the UAE, Stargate UAE, according to the Wall Street Journal. We're also going to discuss how in this like new development, it's not just going to be Qatar that's going to finance Syrian salaries. It's also going to be Saudi Arabia that is joining. And finally, Dubai's Al Habtoor Tower is nearing completion, and we're going to talk more about that and the special man behind it, Emirati billionaire Khalif Al Habtoor.
And the first story of the day, and a historic first, Sheikha Nasser Al Nuwais of the UAE has been elected as the next Secretary General of the United Nations World Tourism Organization, UNWTO, the first woman to hold the post since the body was established in 1975. Her election follows a vote by 35 member states at the UNWTO headquarters in Madrid. Al-Nuwais will officially begin her four-year term in 2026.
Now, you know, this milestone, it marks such a significant breakthrough for gender equality and the Arab world's representation in global tourism governance. And I feel that it also reflects the UAE's rising influence in international institutions, a shift supported by the leadership of President His Highness Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed and Vice President His Highness Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid.
And Al-Nuwais brings over 15 years of experience in tourism and hospitality, serving as the corporate vice president of Rotana.
So interesting.
Yeah, corporate vice president of Rotana Hotel Management Corporation. She also began her career as an auditor at KPMG, one of the Big Five, giving her a strong foundation in financial oversight and governance.
Now, her vision for UN tourism is centered on five key pillars. Responsible tourism, capacity building, technology for good, innovative financing, and smart governance. Now, Al-Nuwais said that these priorities are designed to transform the sector, making it more inclusive, more climate conscious, and resilient to disruption.
And writing on LinkedIn, she said, "As an Emirati woman, I'm honored to make history for a sustainable tourism future that serves communities around the world." Her leadership is expected to guide the UNWTO through an era of global tourism transformation.
I think with this story, the reason why it's so inspiring, Majid, is because this is not the first, this is not just the first Emirati woman who has been appointed for this specific UN tourism role. This is the first woman in the world.
Yeah.
I mean, I look at how, you know, colossal this is. I mean, this is so big. And I think for me as a woman myself, when I reflect on this achievement for the UAE, I'm actually not seeing it as a rarity anymore for women to be appointed for such roles. The female ecosystem in the Middle East, it's so beautiful. You know, you have women like Huda Al-Lawati from Oman. You know, she just raised $2 million for her equity firm, which is like a first. You also have Lubna Alayan from Saudi Arabia, Saudi billionaire. You have Saudi women in Saudi Arabia who are leading most of the hospitality businesses, leading most of the artificial intelligence roles. You have Nour Al-Suwaid from Syria for global ventures. And you also have, I believe, Ula Dadoun, Jordanian. And she's
Ula Dudan, yeah.
Ula Dudan, and she's Jordanian, and she's the founder of Bit Oasis. I mean, the female ecosystem that we have here, it's so beautiful. And I think for me, I love how it's scattered across. You know, they're all from these different places. And honestly, like, they're absolute tigers. They're devouring. They're doing great. And I think this role is a sign of that. And I find it interesting, Majid, how she's a consultant, and she's also in the hospitality sector. So I think that this is going to be a great combination of expertise for the UN.
It was interesting how you called them tiger, not tigresses. But yeah, women. They should be given their due respect. But yeah, women are doing exceptional stuff in the Middle East, in the Arab world. And there's nothing you can do, really. You can just stand up, salute them and salute the expectations that we have now from them.
Yeah.
And they're delivering on them through years and years. Whenever you see any report about women entrepreneurs, women anything, you're just inspired to the like top of, to the end, that they're doing so much. Generally, historically, the Western media has said that, oh, they're so conservative, they don't let women do anything, or their women just do shopping and they earn the money. But it's now very clear that women are going shoulder to shoulder with men in the Arab world.
And this is what I mean. This is what I mean. It's that point of you saying shoulder to shoulder. I called them tigers specifically because when I'm speaking to my mother, Majid, when my mother speaks to me, and this is honestly one of my favorite compliments that she's ever given me. And she looked at me and she's like, honestly, Werd, when I take a look at you, I think of you as you're better than a man. You know, you do what a lot of men don't do.
Yeah.
And to me, in my head, I guess that's the way that I think about it. These women, they're not just women. They're doing a better job than men.
Yeah.
They honestly are. And I forgot to also give these lovely women a shout out. But you have Huda Kattan, Mona Kattan, Huda Beauty completely taking over the world. And with these two, I feel like they're very special because they're not just in the Middle East.
Yeah.
They're worldwide. Anywhere that you go, say the name of the company, Huda Beauty,
and someone
will know it. And I think for me, with their entire brand, Majid, especially with, I never knew that they had Huda Beauty Investments. So basically, Huda Beauty Investments, it's a company, and it works basically as an incubator. So they help all of these startups, they give them funding, they give them resources, they give them investor advice, and a prime example of that is what they've done with Humantra. Both the sisters are board members in the company.
That's it. The only thing right now to do is stand up, give them a standing ovation, praise them for what they're doing, and support them, and make them make history as much as you can.
I think they're supporting themselves just fine.
And second story of the day is really interesting. It happened over the weekend, like just before the weekend, but Elon Musk, richest man in the world, owner of XAI, owner of Starship, owner of literally everything right now, Tesla.
Starlink?
Starlink.
Yeah.
Starlink, Neuralink. There's another
SpaceX.
One. SpaceX. Yeah. SpaceX. So many things. Richest man has reportedly tried to disrupt one of the most high-profile AI deals in the Middle East, the launch of Stargate UAE.
So according to a report by the Wall Street Journal, just days before the U.S.-backed AI project was announced in Abu Dhabi, Musk personally phoned executives at G42, which is headed by Khaldun al-Mubarak, warning that the deal couldn't get past Donald Trump unless his company XAI was included.
And at the time, global tech giants like OpenAI, Oracle, Nvidia, Cisco, and SoftBank were already on board. Musk had learned that Sam Altman was not only part of the U.S. delegation to the Gulf, but that OpenAI had been selected as the lead partner on what's set to become one of world's largest AI data center projects.
And Musk was very furious, and he actually made it known. So according to the report, it said that Musk's threat triggered a last-minute internal review in Washington. But with Trump officials really wanting to see AI grow, especially during the Middle East trip, the project was allowed to move forward. And Musk was once again left on the sidelines as Altman took the spotlight.
This isn't the first time. Just by the way, back in January when the U.S. unveiled its own version of Stargate, which was originally supposed to be in the U.S., a $500 billion AI initiative with OpenAI and others, Musk was inside the White House and only found out in real time, that's what the WSJ, Wall Street Journal report says, he immediately voiced his frustration on X. I remember he tweeted, OpenAI doesn't have the money to carry this out, this $500 billion.
Oh, I remember that. Yeah. And he was right, to be honest with you, because
he didn't have the money, but he somehow managed.
He had the vision.
Yeah.
That's what matters. Fake it till you make it. But it's so clear here that the rivalry between Musk and Altman, it's not just about business. I mean, this is like a geopolitical battle. They want to take lead in every single region, whether that's with NVIDIA chips, partnerships, the kind of influence that they have. And the Wall Street Journal actually also reported that xAI was eventually added to a shortlist of U.S. companies approved for chip exports. But, you know, that's still such a far cry from actually being a part of Stargate.
And Stargate UAE, the whole process. It's just a fight between one of the richest person in the world and one of the most rising prominent person in the world. It's Musk versus Altman. And yeah, that's the story, I guess, for everyone.
Look, to be honest with you, when you actually think about it, like, man, like, wouldn't you be really offended if you were left out of the group outing?
Yeah.
Did you guys...
Being the world's richest guy, spending so much on electing the president, doing so much, and then you're suddenly out of the main highlight AI project.
I get why he's offended, because if you actually see the photo of them like celebrating UAE Stargate largest data center, you see His Highness Sheikh Hamdan, Crown Prince of Dubai, standing there. You see His Highness Sheikh Tahnoon standing there. Yeah. You know, all of these leaders standing
president
together.
President is there. Sam Altman is there. SoftBank CEO is there. They're like, you specifically can see
Trump.
That Musk is missing.
Yeah.
And you're like, what happened here?
You know what it is, honestly. I think this is a really good lesson for him to realize that, you know, you can't just call up Khaldun Mubarak and tell him, man, like, why didn't you include me?
Yeah.
He should have included himself. Why did you end the Gulf tour early? You know, Sam Altman was smart enough to realize, you know what? It's okay that I'm standing far in the line when I'm greeting his Crown Prince Salman. It's totally fine. I'm going to get my chance in the UAE.
Yeah.
I'm going to wait it out. Elon Musk is constantly showing up in video calls. We saw it in Qatar Economic Forum. He wanted to bully that journalist.
Yeah.
You can't just bully people, phone people to get what you want. You have to be there. You have to be present.
Yeah.
And Altman was.
Funny thing, he called out the Wall Street Journal at that event, the Qatar Economic Forum, saying they're the worst publication on the planet.
Now we know
And then
why.
This report came out.
Now
so
we know
he
why.
He called them out and they were like, okay, we will do what you hate us for doing. But yeah, it's really interesting, these dynamics of how globally AI systems, to be honest, it's now a power play in AI because everyone knows how to build data centers. There's no skills that you don't have. First, to be honest, when AI came, OpenAI broke the ceiling and everyone was like, oh, ChatGPT and something can be a reality. Everyone was running after the skills. Oh, who knows how to build them? Who knows what? Now, everyone knows who knows how to build it. The engineers are very apt. They know how to build AI system, LLMs. It's common knowledge now. Now the actual fight is between who will hold the main power, who will become the Google, Microsoft, Apple of AI.
But you know,
and
imagine,
OpenAI right now is leading the charge, to
but
be honest.
But you know, they need to be careful because, you know, just right before the show began, I was telling Majid how I saw this video of this OpenAI employee. I believe his name is William Saunders. And in this like grand speech, he was like, I have just resigned from OpenAI. He was an OpenAI engineer. And what he basically specifically said was, I'm resigning because they've developed a system that highly autonomous that outperforms humans at their most economically valuable work. And basically saying that the reason why I resigned is because the pace that they're going at, it's too quick. And I think when you hear something like that, I mean, there's so much that we don't know about Sam Altman and what he's trying to do and the dangers that this might impose at some point.
With the AI that you see right now, I see everyone, the common people who have access to the basic model of ChatGPT, basic model of xAI, not the paid ones, the basic models. When we look at AI, we think of it as a writer, a researcher maybe, or maybe a financial analyst to an extent, maybe a small video or graphic maker. That's the basic utility we think of. But when these guys, the people who've actually made it, and they talk about it, they talk about AGI. We've talked about it a lot, average general intelligence. That's the basic intelligence, like it's intelligence at the level of a human being, understanding emotions, understanding being manipulative. So you go through the internet every day, you see so much happening. There was just recently a report, I don't know the authenticity of it, just giving you a highlight of what the conversation is about right now, that ChatGPT apparently they had the best system of the ChatGPT paid system. I think it's $200 or something. And they gave it a code and they told it to complete the code. And then in between, midway, they told it to shut it down. And according to OpenAI and all the AI makers in the world, Perplexity, XAI, everyone, an AI cannot override your decision. Mm. So your decision was he was writing a code and then you told it to stop in between and shut down. It didn't shut down. It completed the code and overwrote its protocol for shutting down. So this is like just, I don't know if it's a theory, whatever it is, but at the end of the day, you have to realize when AI reaches that AGI level, average general intelligence level, it will start lying to you, because that's a human trait. Lying, manipulations, thinking about bad stuff. Because I think, to be honest, every human being in their brain, at some point, they've thought about doing bad things, gambling, drugs, whatever. Doing it or not doing it, that's a separate debate. That's an ethical, moral, religious debate. The main idea is AGI is going to think at your level. And that future is not far away. With the way they're building it, with the speed that they're building it, average general intelligence, Sam Altman, I remember very clearly, he said it's 2 to 3 years away. Musk, remember when he was at FII through video call, he said
10% chance that AI
said
might go bad.
4 or 5 years away, AGI, but then he said 10% chance of it going bad. So all these things are there. They're documented. Sam Altman is saying it. Elon Musk is saying it. All the other people who are the engineers, not the very well-known faces, they're all saying it, that AGI will completely change the world and no one is ready for it. To be honest, Sam Altman is not ready for it. The biggest, richest people in the world are not ready for it, because the way they make money is going to change. There's AI programs which are doing better than stockbrokers. So a stockbroker sits on a laptop, imagines, oh, this exact stock can go up, and then he takes someone's money, invests, and makes money for them, and sometimes he doesn't. The best stockbrokers are like 70% of the time they're right. 30% of the time they're wrong. AI isn't. AI has so many calculations going on simultaneously that it can achieve
a correction. And it's a really good writer, too.
So it can be at the level of 95% truth. So stockbrokers will lose their job. Wall Street, the markets will close down, because, to be honest, markets don't know what will happen with such good AGI. So yeah, not a warning signal, not a doomsday call. But the world is going to be a completely new world in 3 to 4 years. And everyone has to be like at a level of skills where he knows how to like go around it. Mm-hmm. Because AI is here to stay. AGI is the next frontier. And as soon as it happens, everyone should be ready for it. We should be ready for it.
They should. And something else you guys should be aware of and ready for is that it's not just Qatar who's going to finance Syrian salaries now. It's actually also Saudi Arabia. So in a move that signals growing regional cooperation and renewed Arab engagement with Damascus, Saudi Foreign Minister Prince Faisal bin Farhan made the announcement during a high-level visit to the Syrian capital.
The support will go towards funding salaries of Syria's public sector employees over a three-month period. And while the exact amount hasn't been made public, this follows a joint $15 million Saudi-Qatari contribution early this year to help Syria clear debt owed to the World Bank.
Actually, Reuters actually did report that they're basically going to give them $29 million per month. Now, the reason why this announcement is so big and it's seen as such a major step is because it's seen as Syria basically reintegrating into the Arab world, not just politically anymore, but economically. And Saudi Arabia in particular has been leading efforts to rebuild ties and encourage more regional stability after more than a decade of strained relations.
And Prince Faisal was joined by an economic delegation in Damascus to discuss cooperation in energy, agriculture, and infrastructure. This follows broader Gulf efforts to normalize relations with Syria and reduce its isolation on the global stage.
And next, Saudi and Qatari investment teams are expected to visit Syria to explore more long-term opportunities. And Syrian President Ahmed al-Sharaa is set to travel to Kuwait, a sign that Arab re-engagement with Syria is gaining momentum. Now, when I take a look at this story, I don't really see it as a charity, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
They're not being charitable here. Okay, maybe slightly, but at the same time, think about it. You have this beautiful nation that does have oil, that does have pipelines, and it's in such a strategic location. Why would you not step in? Are you seeing what I'm saying? You know, with Saudi and Qatar stepping in, as Syria is rebuilding, they're obviously going to make a lot of lucrative deals there, whether it's in schools, whether it's in companies. And in Saudi Arabia and Qatar, what's going to happen to them is that they can take precedent. They can have, whether it's the most shares, and I think for me, I love that it's actually Qatar and Saudi Arabia that are stepping in to finance Syrian salaries, because you know what they're actually doing? They're countering American influence. They're not giving America a chance to step in and do what it always does in the name of promoting democracy. They're not giving it that chance.
What, 14 years since Bashar al-Assad came and left now? For the first time, the U.S. flag was raised in Syria on Sunday, I think. So there is influence. The U.S. has influence over the world. That we have to agree. The good thing that you made the point that Saudi and Qatar, they're being the faces of it. Qatar, you remember, a lot of people reported, Reuters especially reported, AGBI reported, that the salary thing that Qatar promised, they got the green light from U.S. first, and then they promised the salaries, and then now they've started paying those salaries for the public sector employees, not the private companies, only the government employees. Funny thing is that Saudi Arabia led the charge to remove the sanctions. Remember, the things I do for Mohammed, that's what Trump said when he was like being clapped on for removing all the things, the sanctions from Syria. So you have to understand, it's very complicated, but very easily the next big country that they want to make in the Middle East a power, or whatever you can call it, is Syria. So with the names of Kuwait, Bahrain, Oman, Saudi Arabia, UAE and Qatar, now you will see Syria being like in the list of being a good country to invest in. They're opening the stock exchange. There's so much happening right now in Syria that sometimes you will miss something. But you can go to Smashy Business and see what's happening. But apart from that input, the main idea is that Syria has everything now to become a successful country in the Middle East, to be counted among the most successful countries. Mm. What they do from here is now the question. You remember when this happened, when the Lebanon recovery process happened, I was always like, starting the recovery phase is the most difficult part. Mm. But as soon as you start the recovery phase, next 5 to 10 years, decide where your country will go.
Mm.
And Ahmed al-Sharaa, he needs to stay because everyone is putting money on him, on his name. So if he doesn't stay, whoever comes next...
We don't know if he's going to stay.
Yeah, so
his
if there is an election...
It's interesting.
So whatever the election, if somehow the election happens and someone else is selected, would Trump be the same guy and be like, no, Sharaa is not here, sanctions again? Would Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman...
I don't know if you're noticing this, but Ahmed, he's changing his appearance, Majid. If you actually take a look at his appearance, he's now wearing more suits.
Obviously, as a head of state, he has to.
I know, but I mean it...
He started as a rebel sports guy, right?
I mean it in the sense of that he's completely... He knows that the U.S. can step in and say that, okay, they can push that terrorist narrative, that terrorist brand image. And he's completely countering that, because if you actually take a look at the way that he's speaking, his interviews over the years, it's almost like he's being less Arab and less Islamic, but there is nothing wrong with it, because in the position that he is in, you need to do that to stand strong against a nation like America that is always running with that, you know, terrorist, extremist
former
perspective.
Terrorist. Because they still call him a foreign, because he was on the list of American terrorists, but now they've taken him off since the sanctions are off. I think the only transformation that comes to my mind when I think about him is of Che Guevara. So Che Guevara was a rebel forces captain, and somehow he turned into a political leader, like leading people into like farming and all that. So, but he didn't change his suits. He never wore a suit. He still wore that gorilla suit, fighter suit that he wore. But yeah, with Ahmed Al-Sharaa, whoever is advising him is a great guy, because he needs to look like the people who are helping him, or at least he needs to look the role. It's the same idea that you need to suit up or you need to wear the clothes for the job that you want, not the job that you have.
Have you noticed even his beard?
Yeah, very nicely trimmed now.
No, it's trimmed shorter now.
But that's the idea, that you have to dress for the job. It's not like just only physical dressing. It's your mentality. It's the way you speak. You have to completely dress for the job that you want. He would want to be elected eventually. Right now, he's not elected. He's just been put in place.
He has proven himself.
He needs to be elected, because if he continues like this, this turns into a dictatorship. Mm. Because no elections means that he just enforces himself into a position of power that has never held good for any country in the world, and especially the Middle Eastern countries, which have seen, or the Arab countries, because US, as soon as it turns into a dictatorship and you don't toe their line, they'll claim that, oh, you're a dictator. Mm. So he has to get elected. That's the next big step for Ahmed Al-Sharaa. And for Syria, whatever they're getting now, they need to translate into economic benefits for the common people.
Yeah.
Otherwise, if people revolt again, Ahmed Al-Sharaa's legitimacy comes into question.
So,
again, very complicated. At least they've started the recovery process. That's the good news. And I hope it will go towards a better side.
And just to end it on a positive note, Emirati business icon Khalaf Al-Habtour has announced that 800 apartments in the Al-Habtour Tower, one of Dubai's most, you know, prestigious projects that is going on right now, are going to be handed over in 150 days.
And in 150, the handover is scheduled to early November, reinforcing Dubai's position as a global hub for luxury, real estate and investment. Al-Habtour Tower is a cornerstone of Al-Habtour City. I've been hearing this name for a long time. I think they will soon complete it. It's a $3 billion mixed-use development along Sheikh Zayed Road. And this milestone reflects the enduring legacy of Khalaf Al-Habtour, whose business journey began in the 1970s and has since grown into a $22 billion conglomerate.
But just to like talk about, you know, Al-Habtour and how he started, I we said this in a previous show. You know, he was born here in the UAE, in Dubai, in Al-Shindiga in 1949. I mean, that means that this person has completely seen the country grow.
Yeah.
And I was telling Majid this last show, of basically how he, you know, by the royals, he was given the land to build the Metropolitan Hotel. And I was talking to my mother about this, Majid, because she's been living here for quite some time, you know, 30 years. And she was basically saying that Metropolitan Hotel that you're seeing right now, that is right beside Emirates International School Jumeirah, at some point, that hotel actually had the first cinema that even opened in Dubai. And it was in that hotel, and she said you would not believe how the land looked. So, you know, this is a person born and bred here.
Yeah.
You know, they know the land, and I think that can attribute to why his business is such a I think that his business is such a successful business because of him as a character. I don't think that people are just buying into it. They're buying into him, because if you even see the way that Khalaf Al-Habtour talks, and I mean, please, like, I urge you, go watch a video. You find him on the account. He does not have this he doesn't have this air of arrogance that I believe many billionaires do have. You know, this is not an insult. You're billionaires. You can basically do whatever you want. But he doesn't have that air of arrogance. Extremely cultured. I mean,
And beyond business, Al-Habtour is a prominent philanthropist. That's an interesting thing. His foundation supports healthcare, education, humanitarian aid, both locally and internationally. And he has donated millions to causes ranging from Syrian refugees to children's hospitals and women's scholarship. He's very vocal about Gaza. He's very vocal about Syria, Lebanon, whatever is happening in the Arab world. He's very vocal about it.
And he's not afraid whatsoever. And I think what's so interesting is that when Trump was first being appointed as president years ago, I'm pretty sure Khalaf al-Habtour was not happy about it, was he? So, you know, this is a person that is standing for their truth. And with that being said, thank you so much for watching, everyone. That's a wrap for today. And please make sure to check our newsletter and follow us across all of our social media channels. You'll find the subscription link in the description.
And this has been a Smashy Business Show, a Smashy Business production, part of the Augustus Media Podcast Network. A big shout out to our millions of listeners, 1.5 million to be exact. You make this possible. If you're one of them, we appreciate you. Have a great day. See you on Tuesday.